Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in May 2025. Now, what happens when a booming sports nutrition market collides with regulatory reality and patchy evidence? In this episode, we gather a panel of industry experts to delve into the commercial realities facing sports nutrition brands today. They discuss health claims, the novel foods approval process, and maximum vitamin limits.
Whether you're developing products for elite athletes, weekend warriors, or the wellness-minded mainstream, there's something here for everyone. So first, we'll hear from Amy Wheeler. She's Senior Regulatory Manager at the Hut Group and Vice Chair of ESNA. And she'll give us a clear-eyed view of the political, policy, and regulatory landscape for sports and active nutrition across Europe. We'll then turn to the science with Dr. Emily Jevons, and she's a nutritionist for the Cycling Team Picnic Post-NL World Tour Men's Team and Brand Manager at Total Endurance Nutrition. And she'll be exploring the evidence base for supplementation and what's truly needed for performance and recovery. So please join me first in welcoming Amy Wheeler to the stage to get us started. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amy Wheeler. I'm Senior Regulatory Manager at the Hut Group and Vice Chair of ESNA. I'm here today on behalf of ESNA to talk to you about policy and regulatory landscape and sports and active nutrition sector. Firstly, for those who haven't come across ESNA before, ESNA are the European Specialist in Sports Nutrition Alliance. So just a little bit about ESNA. ESNA are the pan-European trade association representing the interests of the sport and active nutrition sector across Europe. They were established in 2003 to prevent the introduction of EU legislation, which could have been damaging to the industry. They represent the businesses and organisations across the entire supply chain towards national and European policymakers, stakeholders and the media. Today, it's an established and respected organisation and the voice of the sector. So just a little on ESNA's objectives. So ESNA's objectives at the moment are removing the regulatory barriers and promoting a positive policy environment for sports nutrition products and active consumers, educating policymakers and regulators on the purpose of sports and active nutrition to achieve positive legislative change, and mitigating challenges and identifying any opportunities linked to the EU and UK regulatory divergence. So positioning ESNA and its members as partners of policymakers in transition to sustainable food systems, tackling inadvertent doping, non-compliance and unscrupulous online vendors to protect the sector and its consumers. Earlier this year, we're just going on to policy opportunities for the vision for food and agriculture now. So earlier this year, the European Commission published its 2025 work programme, where it outlined its ambitions for agriculture and food policy. One of the main objectives of the vision for food and agriculture is to create a fairer and more competitive market. The Commission is also planning to simplify regulations and reduce administrative burdens for food businesses. For our industry, this could mean fewer roadblocks when it comes to bringing innovative products to the European market. More importantly, with the Commission looking at supporting the food industry, sports and active nutrition businesses have now a unique opportunity to lobby for tailored regulations that allow for innovation in the sector. There are specifically a few pieces of legislation where there is certainly room for improvement. So the first regulatory issue that I would like to discuss just relates to the EU single market. The single market aims to ensure the free movement of products across the EU. The mutual recognition legislation is the main framework for this, but there are some issues that need to be addressed. A common problem is member states' different interpretations of EU law and national provisions. We also see often poor applications of the mutual recognition principle. This results in trade obstacles, so the EU needs to ensure the enforcement of this legislation and alignment with relevant national laws. The industry has a great opportunity to work with decision makers to achieve this, and the Commission is now developing its 2025 EU single market strategy. They have launched a consultation on this, and ESNA has responded, highlighting the main challenges for our industry. Moving on to challenges, a concerning issue for the sports and active nutrition industry relates to policymakers' ongoing work on setting maximum amounts of vitamins and minerals in food supplements and fortified foods. Following a request from the Commission last year, the European Food Safety Authority published its scientific opinions on upper levels for various vitamins and minerals. And now decision makers are discussing a calculation method that would set very restrictive maximum amounts. Vitamins and minerals are crucial in sports nutrition. However, decision makers are not necessarily aware of the specifics for sports nutrition products and their role in supporting active consumers' diets and athlete performance. In this context, we're facing the risk of having maximum amounts that will result in some sports nutrition products losing their functionality as they are not able to meet the needs of our consumers. For instance, the Commission is considering a total ban on sodium in fortified foods with the sole exception of carbohydrate and electrolyte solutions. However, many other sports nutrition products contain sodium. If implemented, these maximum amounts and fortification bans for some minerals would not only impact the product's functionality, but also their ability to make and bear authorised health claims. So an example of this is vitamin B6. So they're looking at reducing the maximum limit for vitamin B6. And this would obviously mean that we wouldn't be able to make nutrition and health claims, which are quite common in the marketplace for immunity and tiredness and fatigue. Moving on to nutrition and health claim regulation, this is a main framework for the communication of nutrition and health benefits of sports nutrition products. It establishes an approval process for claims which need to have positive EFSA opinion and approved by the Commission. On one hand, the nutrition and health claims regulation supports transparency and ensures that consumers can trust the claims made by sports nutrition products. Yet the regulation is a very strict approval process that struggles to take into account the needs of active consumers and creates obstacles for our industry. It makes it difficult to communicate the benefits of sports nutrition products effectively. We've seen instances where claims have been positively assessed by EFSA, which have been rejected by policymakers. Just to give a couple of examples, the claims, the benefits of sodium and glucose, for instance, have been rejected on public health concern grounds without consideration for the fact that these ingredients are important for active consumers. What we need is a tailored regulatory framework that is based on independent and sound scientific evidence that considers the needs of different types of consumers to ensure their safety while helping businesses communicate valid claims and support the unique needs of sports people. Another important challenge for the industry is the thousands of health claims for botanicals that currently remain on hold, meaning they have neither been approved nor rejected, because the EU is yet to decide how to handle their assessment. As our attendees already know, botanical extracts and powders can be used in various compositions and ratios in sports supplements. But the issue of the on-hold claims has caused a fragmented market in member states apply different rules. Some allow certain botanical claims under national rules, others strictly prohibit, and they require additional national approvals. So currently, it's difficult to market products with botanicals consistently across the EU. Businesses face competitive disadvantages, legal risks, and uncertainty. This creates an issue from a consumer perspective as well, as consumers receive inconsistent or unclear information about products and benefits. Moving on to novel foods. So the novel food legislation provides very rigorous novel food standards across the EU, which are extremely important for consumer safety. However, the approval process, I'm sure you're all aware, is often lengthy and complex. This in turn creates bottlenecks, delaying the entry of cutting-edge novel foods into the market. This affects both food producers and consumers by limiting access to innovative and potentially beneficial products. We need to have more efficient regulatory framework to assess novel foods quickly and effectively while ensuring consumer safety at all times. Other jurisdictions have made significant progress in speeding up novel food approvals, so the EU must not fall behind to stay competitive. So a final challenge I just want to touch on relates to ultra-processed foods. Over the last few years, we've seen that there's an increasing interest in the impact of UPFs on consumers' health. This is a controversial topic because there are a lot of discussions on the issue in the public domain. So many sports and active nutrition businesses may wonder if there is any threat from our sector. First, what is worth emphasising here is that there are no official definitions on ultra-processed foods. The NOVA system is often used but has several limitations pointed out by credible bodies such as the UK Scientific Advisory Commission on Nutrition. The term UPF doesn't truly reflect the wide variety of products potentially contained within and the specialist nature of some of these products like sports nutrition. So before any useful discussion can take place, it's important to make clear distinctions among the different category of products potentially affected. We need to make sure that the decision makers clearly understand that more processed doesn't always mean less healthy. Any potential policy or legislation that discourages the consumption of UPFs needs to be based on sound scientific evidence to avoid a potential inadvertent negative impact on healthy processed foods such as sports nutrition products. For example, the UK Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition has stated that more research needs to be made to understand any potential link between the consumption of UPFs and negative health outcomes. So just this final slide is just talking about the ESNA's manifesto. So this is provides a brief update on the important initiative from the industry to address the challenges that I've discussed. So just after the official appointment of the new commission in October last year, based on our feedback from our members, ESNA launched a manifesto outlining the priorities of our sector and what policymakers need to do to ensure innovation and fair competition in the market alongside consumer safety. So obviously, as you can see on the slide, the issues that I just discussed were highlighted in this initiative. ESNA has called upon policymakers to recognise the important role played by the sports nutrition in catering for the nutritional needs of people engaged in physical activity. Make sure that any future rules on foods composition acknowledge the nutritional needs of active consumers. Ensure that nutrition and health claims on sports nutrition products positively assessed by EFSA have conditions of use, specifying their use only when the consumer undertakes a certain degree of physical activity. Support a more streamlined system for novel foods to enable innovation while supporting consumer safety, and ensure the correct implementation and enforcement on mutual recognition regulation. Since the launch of ESNA's manifesto, we've been closely following relevant developments and we've been implementing an ongoing public affairs campaign, including engagement with target authorities and regulatory bodies.
Thank you, Amy. That was really, really interesting and a huge role that ENSA plays going forward, particularly with the manifesto upcoming. I'm going to open the floor for questions. We've got a couple of minutes, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
So any burning questions for Amy that we want to ask? Just get you the microphone and you might introduce yourself as well. Thanks a lot.
Ginny Winter, Cardiff Met University. I was just wondering, is there a definition of what is required for people engaged in physical activity? Just because everybody sort of thinks they're an athlete these days. So what would be classed as somebody who would be in this kind of high activity?
So ESNA are more involved in the sports nutrition industry. So I guess anybody participating in any kind of sports and then obviously fueling the body for those sports. I don't think they've defined a full list of what kind of sports are included.
Not so much the actual sports, but more the amount of time people spend exercising or something like that.
I don't think they've outlined that, but I can probably find out for you and come back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Mark Evans from Holland & Barrett. You mentioned a little bit about UPF, and like similarly, we've had kind of internal discussions about HFSS products and whether products in the sports nutrition, active nutrition, for those consumers, whether those should actually be, let's say, for other categories, whether EFSA health claims should actually appear on those if they are HFSS. Whereas, again, like you mentioned, sports nutrition is quite different. And then those consumers might actually be looking for HFSS products mm-hmm. because they're you know, extra nutrients are needed, especially, let's say, the sugar content, carbohydrate content. Are you aware of any discussions in the regulatory world around that, or is it kind of everyone for themselves kind of make internal decisions about how best to?
Yeah, it's a really difficult situation because obviously HFSS, you're really limited in terms of sports nutrition products because they do often come up as higher fat and higher sugar. I know ESNA have been lobbying and CRN, the Council for Responsible Nutrition, I know they've been involved as well in trying to get sports nutrition products as a category. And I know they're having those ongoing discussions. So I'm not sure where those discussions are at the moment, but I know they've taken it to government. So hopefully they will get some feedback soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Amy.
Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Next up, we've got Dr. Emily Jevons, nutritionist, cycling team, picnic post NL world tour men's team, and nutritionist and brand manager for Total Endurance Nutrition. What a title, Emily.
It is. Two different job roles.
Thank you. Over to you.
So, first of all, thanks for all coming and sitting down and listening to me. It's great to see so many faces. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some exploring the evidence base of supplementation. So first of all, what actually is active nutrition? So for me, active nutrition is anyone that's with trying to support anyone who is our everyday hero. So that could be someone doing Couch to 5K. They're still training for something. They're an active individual. Kind of think this kind of goes a little bit on the question that we just had, like what actually classes as someone as an athlete versus someone who's just training. Anyone who's doing structured physical activity for a purpose, in my opinion, should be starting to look at active nutrition rather than just someone who's maybe just trying to do a little bit for their health. So if they're doing structured exercise with a purpose of getting somewhere, I think they class as an athlete, in my opinion. It's not all about the elites. But we are also thinking about our elite athletes here. So it's a very broad topic, active nutrition, and how we kind of make it meet everyone is the topic of conversation. So we need to think about macronutrient timing. So carbohydrates in particular, probably the biggest playing a role in our energy expenditure for exercise, but also protein obviously plays a key role, especially when we're thinking about recovery. But we can also think about micronutrients, those key little things that we can change more at the elite level there, really, to help with recovery too. Hydration strategies as well, especially if we're going to continue with some warm weather. Let's manifest it, everyone. And also dietary supplements, which is what we're here to kind of really knuckle down on and discuss today. It is obviously a huge industry, and it's going to continue to grow if the world keeps exercising. And we're definitely seeing a boom. I don't know if anyone's noticed in the UK. Everyone's running suddenly. I mean, it's great. I'm all for it. Let's keep it up. But this industry is only going to continue to grow, hopefully, across the world. So next up, what is a supplement? So I've put the definition up here. Unfortunately, the yellow and white doesn't work too well, I appreciate now, so I will read it out for you all. But if we're looking at what a supplement is in terms of the sports nutrition world, and actually within my industry in particular, this is what we have as our last kind of main statement. So it's from the International Olympic Committee. It is in 2018, so we are probably due an upgrade on this now, but it's the last consensus statement we had. So it's a food component, any nutrient that someone is wanting to ingest purposefully in order to either help with their exercise or health performance. So it's actually trying to gain those benefits and they're purposely taking that. That is what we are seeing as a supplement. So why someone might actually take a supplement, there's going to be a variety of different reasons depending on who they are and what they're trying to achieve. So it might be that they want to recover better from their exercise. It might be for the convenience. That's a huge one nowadays with these busy lives that everyone's leading. It might be for cognition as well. I definitely think that's an upcoming one. I touched back on that at the end. I know obviously we've already kind of mentioned nootropics. I do think that's a more of an upcoming area in sports nutrition. To improve health as well, even some people could even class a multivitamin if they're trying to do it for an active reason. They might go, oh, this is going to help me in becoming a healthier individual if we're thinking about those people doing Couch to 5K. Weight loss and gain as well, they might be trying to use supplements to help them with those goals to improve their performance in general and how they're actively actually performing, thinking both aerobic and aerobic, to prevent or treat illness, to help with their immunity as well. If they stay better and healthier, then they're not going to get ill as much. It's more time they can exercise and actually perform. And obviously compensation for a poor diet. Unfortunately, a lot of people do reach for supplements because they are struggling to meet it in their diet. And although we would like a food-first approach most of the time, it doesn't always work, and the supplement industry is booming for that reason. There are a few issues to consider with supplementation in the active and sports nutrition industry as well. So thinking about the cost, it's not accessible to everyone, across the world anyway. Is it actually supported by research? We see a lot of supplements being developed. I have a background in academia for reference there. I know that wasn't included, but a lecturer for a few years and PhD. So thinking about the actual research that's going into this, a lot of the time we're not seeing direct evidence. They might share the research based on certain ingredients in supplements, but no one's actually looked at if that supplement is working sometimes. It's not always the case, but it is sometimes something we see as an issue. Any side effects from this? Have they actually looked at if this supplement corresponds with how it interacts with any medications and things? Are these actually being looked at and advertised? Thinking more for a sport-specific kind of application for the end ones there. Ethical unfair advantage, thinking about the cost and availability. Does every athlete at a top level across the world have access to that supplement? Does it give an unfair advantage to certain parts of the world? Contamination as well. Are they safe to consume as well? Or could they be contaminated by something that could be banned in their sport? A lot of athletes, even though we have the 100% Me campaign, and it is their accountability to check these things. A lot of athletes aren't, let's say, literal with their actual checking of their supplements, and they just assume that they'll be safe because it's a big brand. So reasons why a food-only approach might not always work, as said, is usually what we would want people to go with, but why supplementation might play a role is some nutrients are actually pretty difficult to obtain from foods at the level that we see a benefit for in research, so they might consume it for that way. Some athletes might just be fussy. we do have fussy eaters out there, and so they might take supplements for that reason, that they can access it in another way. Again, the ergogenic benefits of some of the supplements that we look at are actually really hard to bioavailable get from food at the certain amounts. And it's also very variable between certain foods as well. Sometimes, again, the concentrated doses are already there. Some foods might be difficult to consume. I'm not sure how many people do exercise quite regularly, but unfortunately, a lot of us actually have like this suppressed appetite after exercise, which is really inconvenient when you want to optimize your recovery. So again, supplements can be really helpful for that purpose. And again, tested supplements can actually be really beneficial if you are concerned about contamination from food in certain places in the world. As an example from like my role within cycling, we have certain countries where we have to be careful of our riders consuming meat in their countries because of the risk of contamination. And so having supplements would actually be a much safer opportunity for when they're traveling to those countries. So what evidence do we actually need to look at sports nutrition? Like, what should we be looking at behind the scenes? What should be going on in the labs, the universities? Any universities here, please carry on the research because we need it. Thinking about our first initial ideas, we need to consider what the supplement actually is, who your target audience is. Is it more of your active individual that's trying to exercise day to day, or is it the elite level? Because they are a slightly different population and the needs will be different as well. Is it going to be useful for exercise day to day? Is it more going to be useful for competition? They're also a good example of that is tart cherry juice. I'm not just talking cherry juice from like Tesco or something, but actually tart cherry juice in particular. Is really good for helping with muscle damage and recovery, but it's actually been shown that during training, it could actually blunt the adaptation response. So it's more relevant to have it during races when you want to recover optimally than trainings. We want to have those adaptations. Little things like that. Is it useful for training or competition? Does the supplement actually work? So a more general version of this, like this is the next step in the research. How does it work? Actually thinking about the mechanisms behind it. Which population is going to benefit the most? What's the best protocol for it? How is it practically going to be used? Which situations might it be useful for? And then we can think more specific about it as well. So will this actually improve performance? Is it going to be mental? Is it going to be a physical benefit? These are all the steps that we should be taking when we're thinking about how we can actually evidence a supplement. But then we need to get even more specific, ideally, if we can, in the research and actually think, okay, the how will it hold up in certain temperatures if it's something that we're orally taking? Is it going to be safe to use it along other sides, alongside other supplements as well, or will it cause some interactions? So in my opinion, this is probably like the basic kind of step-by-step process that we need to think about when we're looking at supplements and actually think about the evidence base that we need to prove if they're worthwhile or not. This is not just about individual ingredients within a supplement, but the supplement as a whole too, and how it comes together. What's the evidence? Let's go through some popular supplements, let's say, because again, I was kind of given this topic talk and I was like, there's so many things I could cover here, but what do we see as really popular supplements and actually are the evidence? Starting off with protein supplements. In general, these are very, very popular and they have been for a number of years now, but I still think they could actually be used more, especially in more elderly populations where we're seeing that muscle protein synthesis, obviously sarcopenia is happening. So we're losing muscle mass and just naturally as we age, unfortunately, which is a very sad thing about aging. So I think we could actually promote using protein supplements further to other populations that need it. But it's very well evidence-based. It's known to support muscle protein synthesis, especially those containing leucine, which is an essential amino acid. If we think about creatine, again, this is probably one of the most research sports nutrition supplements that we see, and I think it's only going to boom further. It's actually very cheap. It's quite cost-effective. It's accessible. The most bioavailable form is powder. I know we're starting to see the development of creatine gummies, but as far as I'm aware, the most efficient way is still the powder, but I think it's going to continue to grow. We've got lots of research on it, but it's also now going more into the world of like cognitive health as well, and we're seeing it more in neuroscience, and I think that's one to watch. BCAAs, they've shut down. The research there was the kind of evidence that, yes, we can use branched-chain amino acids, but over the years, the evidence has now shown us that actually having whole protein sources or more just essential amino acids and the whole nine is actually more effective in building muscle protein synthesis. So these have kind of gone down in trending lately, and the evidence there is kind of reflected on that too. Caffeine and electrolytes I've kind of put together here in the fact that caffeine is a very well-established ergogenic aid in research, so it's very well evidenced. Electrolytes also there for both during exercise and recovery. But in general, I think electrolytes are actually starting to be overused. And this is where your everyday individual who mentioned kind of doing like couch to 5K, they might not need as much electrolytes as they're seeing on like TikTok or Instagram, and actually you're starting to overconsume it when we already have a population that probably overconsumes salt. So that's probably something that needs to be looked at more in research, and actually how do we kind of get this messaging across on who needs electrolytes and who doesn't. Personal recommendations are always required, but yeah, we need to identify that in a bit more detail, I think. Sports collagen in particular, so not collagen thinking about, you know, hair and nails, but more thinking about injury prevention and how we can actually benefit the tendons and recovery. There's lots of research within like ACL injury, which has been really beneficial, but there's also evidence saying that actually if someone's already having a high protein diet that already contains the amino acids that are going to cause collagen production, might not be as beneficial. So I always like to think of collagen as more of an insurance policy if you're not sure if your protein intake is high enough. Greens powders, sorry if this upsets anyone in the room. The evidence base that I've generally seen is not as strong as we'd hoped. I think it does have some evidence, but it seems to be more indirect on like certain ingredients. So this ingredient causes this rather than the supplement as a whole. So it's definitely lacking more direct. Again, I don't know that every single green supplement, please correct me if you know one that has more research base for it. But at the moment as a whole, there does seem to be a bit of a lack of direct evidence. But they do still have roles, especially like when you're traveling and stuff and you know you're not getting it in your diet. Thinking back to the International Olympic Committee's actual consensus statement in 2018, there's only actually very few supplements that they say has enough of an effect to be listed in this consensus statement. Caffeine, creatine, nitrates, sodium bicarb, and possibly beta-alanine. I do think we're due an update because it was 2018 now, but you can see there, considering the amount of sports nutrition supplements we see on the market and how much research is being done, this is all that they're counting as actually having enough evidence at that point. So considering the list that we have, it's interesting that that's all we are seeing. Little bit of a note on what I think is gaining momentum and where I think research should continue to grow, because we need the evidence to support this. more plant-based supplements are definitely becoming popular. It's been continuing for a few years. I do think this is set to continue to grow. Supplements for immunity as well, immune health, probably still off the back of COVID, but people are wanting to not get ill as often for various reasons. I think if we think about active populations in general, if athletes get ill, they're taking time out of the training, it affects them, that's their job at the end of the day. So I think immune health will be a big one. Cognitive function, I think we've already kind of mentioned nootropics a little bit today, but I think that's continuing to grow. We've seen a lot of research and evidence more in like military-based populations, but we're still lacking a little bit in sport populations. Although I've seen like energy gels with nootropics that have come out now. So it's definitely starting to venture in the sports nutrition world. Gut health will continue to grow within this industry as well. I think we're also going to see more female-specific supplements coming out, and we definitely need more evidence in females. Anyone here who's doing research, please include females, because we are hugely lacking it. I think in the last meta-analysis that looked at the actual evidence base of male to female, I think only 6% of sports science research was done in females only. Like, it's appallingly bad, so we definitely need more of that before these supplements actually come out. I think one of the biggest issues, though, in the evidence base is this lack of randomized control trials for across the board of the actual supplement rather than the ingredients itself. But we also have this very much like this varying manufacturing standards across the world, and that also could do with being addressed. How can we actually look at how safe a supplement is and if it's trusted? I do think if anyone in here is developing supplements that are for active individuals or especially the elite individuals, you should be looking at something like Informed Sport. I know it was in Amy's slides before, the LCG Labs, these are something we want to promote this even further for that supplement safety. It allows athletes to take control of their own choices. They can download certificates to say, yes, I've checked that this is evidence-based and it's safe for me to consume. So that is what I think we should be pushing for in the development of new products. So finally, here's my final slide, really. Food First is really good in general for all of our health, but not food only for a lot of active individuals. We do have this role of supplements, and I do think the product development can continue if we have the right evidence. I think evidence, health, and safety should be our number one priority in the development of these. And then let's hopefully we can get a lot more people actively looking after their health. And also let's get a bit higher in sport, because we're still not always on the best of the league tables in different sports, are we? So yeah, thanks for listening to me ramble, guys, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you, Emily.
Fascinating.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Ascot in October and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com.